mixing and matching and doing a few different things. But now I don't have any time, and so the malt's starting to get old. And it actually it affected the flavor, but it ended up being it was kind of interesting. It was a good flavor.
I'd like to call the Senate Higher Education Committee to order. This afternoon, the first thing we have on our agenda is the confirmation hearing for the Director of the Office of Higher Education, Dr. Sheila Wright. And so we'd ask Dr. Wright to come to the table, and I guess we would, if you have any comments you want to make, and then we would take questions from the committee if they have any. So welcome to the committee, Dr. Wright.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is Sheila Wright. I am the director of the Office of Higher Education. Just as a way of a little bit of background, my experience in education extends over 30 years, both in P-12 and in higher education. And really, I can't remember a single day of my life in which education was not a part of it. It's a part of my upbringing and a part of my background. It was part of the conversations of my household with my parents, both of whom were very strong advocates of education, so I didn't have a choice. And I ended up, as a child, growing up in a very rural town with a community that was committed to education. So the values and the principles of what I grew up in have been instilled in me a value for community service and giving back. I think that's the part of public service that is so important. It's an investment in the future. It is a way of contributing something more powerful than yourself. So there are interests greater than self-interest here, and interests that are absolutely critical for the future of our state. And I'm very, very committed to that goal, and see that early beginning, whether it was desegregating schools in North Carolina, to acquiring advanced degrees in curriculum and instruction and working in higher ed with some outstanding colleagues who have informed my thoughts and my thinking over the years. But most importantly, students have been at the center of everything that I've done. From the students that I gave a vow to, who were middle school students, that I would work diligently to place in front of them teachers who were well prepared and well informed, to the students that I worked with who were themselves teachers as graduate students, returning to advance their understanding about the world and the work that they did. Throughout all of it, students have been at the center. And the Office of Higher Education is about students. It's about providing that affordability for and access for students to enter into school and to have their same aspirations and dreams that I did. And so that's at the core of what we do. It's also about helping them be better consumers about the multiple pathways and choices, the wide array of post-secondary options, whether it's a certificate, whether it's community college, whether it's four-year institution. We provide critical information to students to help them make that choice. And the Office of Higher Education is also about providing a service to the institutions themselves, a service to the institute, all of U.S. policymakers, and gathering data that help us all to make informed decisions about where we are. So that pretty much sums up who I am. I'm a small-town girl from a place I call I-95 in Stuckey's. and I just grew up with a lot of that was provided to me, and I want to give it back. In ways that are meaningful and purposeful and intentional and that have a higher calling for that.
Well, thank you very much. Are there any questions from the committee? I know I had the opportunity to meet with you. You were kind enough to come in and see me, and we had a very nice time, nice discussion. So I don't know if there are any questions or any comments. Well, I will say this. We do not have quorum. And so we will have to postpone the actual vote until we have a few more members come into the room. So I know that the Office of Higher Ed wants to or is going to offer us some information this afternoon. So maybe if we move on to that, and as soon as we establish quorum, then we will move on with the motion.
I'm inviting my colleagues, Dr. Mark Misikonis and Ms. Tricia Grimes, to join us, Senator.
Yes, thank you. Well, whenever you're ready, is.
Sure. Madam Chair, members, again for the record, Mark Misikonis for the Office of Higher Education. The committee should have a chart, legal size chart, both sides. There's some numbers on. We don't have a presentation. This is the governor's budget. Is in the simplest way that we could present it. Pretty straightforward.
Before we get into the details of the budget, which my two colleagues will present, let me just give you a kind of brief version, Senator and members. The governor's budget calls for a reduction of $171 million to the Office of Higher.
I'm sorry, just a second. Is there a place for Senator Anderson there? Okay. We have a new member. I believe you're here where Senator Scoey. No, where Scoey. I'm sorry. We have a new member today, and so we're trying to make sure. Senator Scoey was replaced by Senator Anderson, so we welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
And we have quorum, so we will deal with that. We will deal with that motion. And I'm sorry to interrupt, so please proceed. Please, I'm sorry. Go ahead, and we will. We've got that taken care of.
I didn't know if you wanted to do your vote first or not.
Well, is there Senator Carlson? Would you like to make a motion right now, and we'll deal with the vote?
Good. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'd like to move that the committee recommend that the Senate consent to the appointment of Dr. Sheila Wright as the director of the Office of Higher Education.
Thank you, Senator Carlson. Moves that we recommend the appointment, the confirmation of Dr. Sheila Wright. Any discussion? Senator Brown.
I would just like to speak in support of Dr. Wright's confirmation. I'm very impressed with her and had a nice visit with her and would hope that we could confirm her.
Thank you. Any further discussion on that motion? All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion does prevail, and we've passed that confirmation onto the confirmation calendar on the floor. Thank you very, very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate the honor. As I stated, we have been asked to give an overview of the budget for the Office of Higher Education. Just as a way of a brief introduction, I will make a couple of remarks, and then I'll turn it over to my colleagues to describe to you some of the details that are involved in the decisions that we've made. Very briefly, the governor's budget calls for a reduction of $171 million to higher education. This budget focuses on critical services to higher education and recognize the need to protect the core services that are essential to students and also to the academic missions of the institutions themselves. The $171 million is primarily focused on a 6% reduction to Minnesota State Colleges and Universities and University of Minnesota, and it recognizes that that 6% is the absolute limit given previous years of reductions that would allow the institutions to protect their academic core and keep tuition at a minimum for students, so it's student-centered. That budget of $171 million and that 6% reduction would allow us to protect the core service that the Office of Higher Education has, which is the student grant program. The student grant program, as many have testified before, has been in existence since 1967 and provides support for those who are lower and middle income students to gain access and affordability to college and into college of their choice. So it's the primary vehicle by which all of us provide that promise for higher education for our students. It's absolutely critical that the state grant program be held constant given those reductions from previous years. And in addition to the around $152.7 million, which would be the result of the 6% reduction, $18.2 million comes from grant programs that the agency administered, and that's what we're going to walk you through today. But before I turn this over to my colleagues, I want to stress upon all of us that we are in a critical juncture. What we have before us is this, quite simply. the institutions of higher education, whether it's Minsky, whether it's the University of Minnesota, whether it's for-profit, whether it's private, regardless of the type of institution, collectively they form the economic engine of the state. And so whereas we recognize a $6.2 billion deficit before us, that economic engine and their academic core and their missions have to be held constant. Earlier when I was introduced to this body, and many have said before, that there is, by 2018, 70% of the jobs in Minnesota will require post-secondary education. Let me break that down to you quite simply. It means this. Between 2008 and 2018, new jobs in Minnesota requiring post-secondary education and training will grow by 152,000 new jobs over and above what we already need. Now, if you factor in people who are nearing the end of their careers and their retirements to that, what we are talking about are 902,000 vacancies in Minnesota alone. So all of that has to be filled somehow. And what that means in terms of jobs, in terms of the careers that are of most interest, and this is coming from the Georgetown study, is that most of the jobs will require either associate's degree or bachelor's degree or graduate degree. So education is absolutely essential to Minnesota right now, and that the investment that you're making by holding the cuts to the two critical systems to a minimum and by protecting the state grant really is an investment that is about creating a sustainable core for Minnesota's long-term viability. Managerial and professional office careers, STEM careers, community service and the arts, but most importantly, education, teachers fueling our P-12 system, healthcare. All of those careers, in addition to sales and office support and other kinds of careers that would be left vacant that will need to be filled, now have to be retrained. Those jobs require new technologies, new ways of knowing, new ways of thinking. And I'm struck at the moment that we are in history here in Minnesota. I'm struck by Albert Einstein's comments that we can't solve problems at the same level of thinking that created them. And we have reached a point, I'm begging you, that reached a point where we can no longer draw from our two systems if those two systems are going to be prepared and positioned to fuel that engine. And that's the stage that we have before us in making decisions right now, and the stage at which I asked my colleagues to now walk through what that $18.2 million mean, the programs that, what reduction would mean to the two systems, and what the $18.2 million, the programs that's involved in those decisions. Those programs are absolutely essential as well. But as I said last Monday, we're at that point of hypothermia where we have to draw from the extremities in order to protect the core. And so if we have any more reductions to the Office of Higher Education, it will come from these programs. Programs like work study, programs like child care that also provide support, especially for the lower and middle income students to have access and affordability to college. And what it would end up being in reality if those programs were cut to non-existent, we would be talking about, in effect, amputating the extremities. So I say that with all sincerity, that we have reached a point in higher education where we are at a zone of proximal development and a zone of proximal critical state, that any more will most assuredly place those institutions and their infrastructures and their academic core and their ability to provide services to students, it would render them in a very critical state. So with that, I turn it over to my colleagues.
Excuse me just a moment. Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Wright, I missed the year that there's going to be 900,000 openings.
According to the Georgetown, according to the Georgetown study, it's by 2018. That's 7 years from now.
Okay. Right. Thank you. Mr. Mitchell-Canis.
Madam Chair, and then members, again, I'll point out this legal-sized document that we'll be working from. And again, our intent was to simply present the governor's budget in as straightforward a way as possible. If I may start with the side that says the University of Minnesota Minsky and the Mayo Medical School. And again, it's very straightforward. We have here before you the base funding for 2012-2013, the reduction of 6%, and that's fairly clear across the board. Listed there is a number of the special appropriations that are typically made in the higher education bill. And again, those reductions are evenly made across all of those. So you see the remaining amount under the governor's recommendation. I would point out for the committee's benefit, Dr. Wright talked about the 6% reduction, but this is against the starting point, the base of the forecast. The legislature last year increased that base over current year spending, so it's a much higher amount that you're starting from, which means that when you reduce it, you actually are mitigating the impact on the two systems. In the case of the University of Minnesota, their spending over the current year is actually going up in the governor's recommendation, so I just wanted to point that out. One other thing about the university, and I think we wanted to show that,
can you explain that a little more? Because I think I have, and we did make it available to the members. I've got Maya Ms. Weidman, I should say, put together just a spreadsheet here that does, and if we look at that second page, and I'm sorry, I think you guys have a copy of this. Maybe you could just explain it a little better. Did I hear you correctly saying that the spending increases?
Yes, Madam Chair, if I can find it on the document.
And the U of M is on that second page. Well, I guess it's on page 3 is what it's called here.
It is. And
line 64.
Yes.
And I guess maybe you could just explain that a little better. I'm trying to figure out where that
Well, with what Ms. Weidman showed on here is a combination of 10 and 11, and then annually for 12 and 13. I think the way the University of Minnesota, for instance, has been talking about this, Dick Fitzenreiter says, uses the number $591 million. That's what they have the current year. Fiscal 11 is where they're starting from. That's what they're spending. Over there right now, $591 million. You won't see that on here because what you have here is a November forecast for 10 and 11. You have a two-year number there. What you have on the sheet that we have presented you is the base. Again, it's a two-year base of the $1,284,000,000. And you'll see that in the fourth column under the University of Minnesota on page 3 there. Under the November forecast for 12 and 13. That's the starting point. So if you simply multiply the 591 by 2, you have 1182. So the 1182 under the base forecast goes to the 1284. But the governor's recommendation has it down to 1207. So the 1207 is higher than the 1182, essentially. So their spending, even under the governor's recommendation, is actually going up from the current spending level.
I'm letting this sink in. Are there any other questions from the committee? Because I'm feeling
like your question is, it says 1,217 on the spreadsheet. Isn't that your question?
The base was set high.
Madam Chair, we get stuck on this thing around here quite a bit, this biennial budgeting. And we always put two numbers together. But the fact is that institutions work on a year-by-year budget.
Okay. Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, I'm trying to get my head around this, too. So the change from 1182 to 1284, that fiscal year 10-11 to 12-13, that was one-time money or not?
No, this is base funding. This is ongoing base money.
Madam Chair, if I might try to add a little to the discussion. In the appropriations bill at the end of the 2010 session, a base budget was established in session law for the University of Minnesota and Minsky that was higher in fiscal year 12 than the amount they actually received in appropriations for fiscal year 11.
So, Ms. Grimes, that's in here, that $60 million, that there, $59 million, where is that reflected?
So that's reflected in the 642 numbers for 12 and 13 that are columns 2 and 3 that add up to 1 $1,284,000,000 there. If the amount for fiscal year 11 had been the same amount as the base for fiscal year 12, it would have been $591 million each year in 12 and 13 for a total of $1,182,000,000 for the biennium. But so by law, the legislature wanted the University of Minnesota and Minsky base to be higher than the amount they actually received in the appropriation for fiscal year 11, because the hope was that the appropriation for fiscal year 11 was a one-year reduction that would not have to be carried forward. Okay. I'm not sure if that helped.
And let me try this again, and stop me if I'm wrong. But so on the sheet that you provided, the colored sheet, this University of Minnesota, this 1-2 here on the first line, is the number including the 59?
Yes.
That they had, okay. That makes much more sense now, because then my understanding on this, Ms. Weidman, that you put together, it does not have the 59. Is that correct?
It does on the fourth. It does on the fourth.
The 591.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's the 59 or 60 that was reflected in this 1-2.
It's here.
But they never actually received it. Is that correct?
Madam Chair,
that was one time. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. But it is reflected in this 1-2, is what my understanding from the question I just asked. Is that correct, Ms. Grimes?
That's my understanding. Another way to look at it is that if you look at the governor's rec column for fiscal year 12 and 13, that's 10 columns over to the right, where it says $1,207,244,000, that number is higher than $1,182,000,000, which would be the fiscal 11 amount times 2. So that because it started from a higher base, when the governor took the 6% reduction, the net amount is still an increase over what the fiscal year 11 amount would have been times 2.
So what they did is, under this budget, they just lost part of the $60 million that they didn't get last year.
That's right.
Thank you. Okay, mysterious $60 million. All right. All right, I'm sorry.
No, ma'am. This whole thing with biennial budgeting gets very difficult, because we typically multiply numbers by 2, but organizations don't work that way. They work a year at a time. So,
Senator Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what is there from the 2010 funding, the 591, what's the percentage increase that they're actually getting under the governor's budgets? Because I don't think we should be looking at this as a 6% decrease. We should be looking at it as a percentage of an increase. So that number would be 591 is what they got 2010.
Madam Chair, members, the 591 is the current year of spending. The governor's rec is 603, so the difference is $12 million. Whatever 12 divided by 591 is. Would be the percentage that you'd be thinking of.
Thank you.
And this is percent, this total.
Yeah. Some fraction of percent.
Less than a percent.
Less than Mr. Canis.
Madam Chair, and the members, again, Minsky is very much the same way. This is a 6% cut that you see on the chart there. I'm sorry, backing up just to the University of Minnesota, there's a footnote there, and we did want to point out that in the health department recommendation, there is a health grant dealing with that makes grants to the dental school, the academic health center, and the hospitals, and in its connection with the University of Minnesota, where there are some adjustments in those grant amounts, too. So I would refer you to those pages to see what those amounts are. But it does influence the activities at the University of Minnesota. Madam Chair, if I, as I always hate to do, point out a mistake on one of our charts here. The amount for the Mayo Medical School is only an annual number. That should be doubled to 2701. That number is simply incorrect. It's not the full base for the 2 years. It's only an annual number. So that should be changed to, as I mentioned, 2701. But, again, there's no reduction in that recommendation from the base. So,
where is that, Madam Chair, where is that number you're referring on the
Senator Sharon?
Did you I'm on the wrong spot. Okay. Thank you very much, Chair.
Yep.
I'm going to try that if I could ask the members just to flip the page over. And this is more detail on our office. Again, with the system reductions, those respective boards will have to make the decisions on how they allocate those that spending internally. We have much more detail on the programs that we operate. So if I may point out, this is the list of the programs that appropriations are made for in the higher education bill usually. As Director Wright pointed out, the bottom line is an $18,200,000 reduction. This was a target that we were required to reach. It's not quite a 5% reduction in the base. And I'm not going to go through each of these lines, but I think I would like to point out the important ones, unless there's questions. We're of course happy to answer any questions on the sheet itself. The state grant program was a high priority, as Director Wright pointed out. The recommendations essentially hold that harmless. You'll see in front of you a very, very small increase of $200,000, but that is simply a shift from the Safety Officers Survivors Program into that appropriation. The eligibility for the Safety Officer Survivors Program does not change at all. It simply is where the money comes from. And this is a way of easing the appropriations and making sure that at the end of the day that we spend all the money that's appropriated to us through the transfer process that we have. So we're trying to mitigate any issues with that by making that transfer. The state work study is the one program that took the largest reduction, roughly 33%. That is simply if you're trying to hit $18 million and you don't have many options trying to hold a state grant, there's not much left in the budget to make up that amount. So,
And could you tell me on that one, it says on this sheet approximately 3,500 fewer students will be employed at state work study fund, state work study. What is the total number? You said it's a 33% cut. Now, is that the money or the numbers of the students? I'm just wondering about the number of students we serve totally. And then what's the average award, I guess, is what you would, or the work study program numbers?
Madam Chair, there's a little more than 10,000 students that get a work study annually, 10,700. I believe that's in your budget documents, but that's the rough amount. They roughly get $1,300, $1,350 a student. So if you divide the $1,350 into the reduction in the appropriation, you get about 3,500 students. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that there'll be that fewer students getting jobs. Institutions have work-study money that they have internally. They have federal work-study money. So they can have the ability to move money around to reduce the number of students that are affected. Of course, they may receive less work-study money because it simply works out that way. But there's a lot of flexibility at the institution level to deal with it.
Okay.
The achieve program in this recommendation is eliminated. This has been a program that's gone through a number of ups and downs in the last couple of years. Was initiated back in 07 and had some adjustments made. If Senator Pappas, of course, remembers that because she worked quite a bit on that as well. But again, there's nothing on this page that's easy to do, by the way, Madam Chair and members. So this was a program that was recommended to be eliminated. The college savings plan match. This is match for savings to families of low income. The appropriation initially for this was $1 million. Last year was reduced to $700,000. This year we spent $328,000. It simply is hard to for low income families to save for college. So the take up rate on this has not been large over the course of time. It's been around for about 10 years. And try as we may, it's been a hard one to kind of get low-income people to do. The $350,000 you see remaining there is for fiscal 12. That is for contributions made last tax year during 2010. And the thought was people made those contributions based on this promise should be made. That payment goes out the 1st of July of 2012. So,
And I was under the impression that in that program, we matched it and put it into – it's not a tax refund. You're talking about the money that goes into the – fund for them. Okay.
Yes, Madam Chair.
So we only make that payment once a year? Is that what?
Well, essentially, we paid into a trust account. The families don't get the money until
I understand that. But that's what you make that payment into the trust account once a year.
Yes.
How many families does that 350 cover? Or
About 2,500.
About 2,500. Thank you.
Mr. I should point out to the members, though, that the program itself is still alive. I mean, this is the savings program. There's nearly $700 million of assets by other people. This just deals with the matching program for low-income families. The child care grants.
Excuse me. Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is this the one where you have to have a minimum of $200 invested in a year in order to get the match?
Madam Chair and members, Tomasoni, no, I think it may be $200 to start it, but I understand you can have contributions as low as $25.
So you can put in $25, but in order to get the match, you have to have put in $200 in a year, right?
Madam Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, I don't think so. In order to establish an account to begin with, I think you have to contribute $200 for the year. No. Can we check that and get back to you?
Well, what my question is leading to, is there a maximum that there's that you can contribute that will get a match?
$400.
Ms. Grimes, okay. Senator Tomasoni. Mr. Michikanis.
Chairman, members, the next two of the post-secondary child care grants, American Indian Scholarship, received this 5% reduction across the board. I've already talked about the Safety Officer Survivors Program. The next two are the agency administration and Unitex, again, the 5% reduction. Interstate reciprocity under this recommendation has no reduction, but unfortunately, that's a program either you have to essentially do it all or you don't do any of it. This is an appropriation for a payment to North Dakota for the exchange of students between North Dakota and Minnesota. And it's essentially we're contractually obligated under the agreement to make payments to them for this purpose. So you can't really take money out of it because you still have the obligation. I should point out, Madam Chair, members, this is a very difficult program to project. Last year we came in with, a deficiency appropriation request that the legislature granted, and it's just a hard one because of the flow of students between the two states. The Midwest Compact is similar. That's an obligation to MEC, Midwest Compact, of $95,000 a year. The next two parent information and the Get Ready Outreach, 5% reductions as well. MMEP, again, that's a grant to the partnership that does extensive advocacy work. The United Family Practice program under this recommendation is eliminated. Again, these are all difficult choices to make, but difficult to get to.
Excuse
and then
me.
Finally,
Senator Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you describe for me what exactly the United Family Practice is and how many residents per year benefit from that?
Madam Chair, could I explain that?
Senator Pappas.
Thank you. Prior to me even being on the Higher Education Committee, the legislature recognized that we had a shortage of family practice doctors, both in the urban area and in rural Minnesota, and started providing some subsidies for these residents. I think it's about $20,000 a year. In this program, there's probably 18. You have to do the math for it. But we have like four or five of these programs, St. Cloud, University of Minnesota, Mayo. Maya would have to give us the whole list. But what happened over the years is they were all getting uneven amounts. Some were getting, $15,000 a resident. Some were getting $25,000 a resident. And United Family Practice, because it was never getting anything. So when I became chair, I tried to just even out the appropriations so all of them would get the same thing so it would be fair to everyone and included United Family Practice. Unfortunately, this stands out because the other programs now are administered through the University of Minnesota Specials. So the program is just kind of rolled into the specials. And if the specials get a 5% reduction, they'll get a 5% reduction. But United Family Practice is operated by Allina and United Hospitals, not by the U of M, and so they've had a separate line item. For a while, St. Cloud had a separate line item, too, but then they were, taken over by the University of Minnesota. So it's really kind of unfair to target them because we're not targeting the other programs, And if we still feel like we have a responsibility, we just decided we wanted to help out with this shortage of family practice doctors and have been funding them for over a decade.
Senator Brown.
So, Senator Pappas, do you know how many residents per year that would affect by cutting this?
Senator Pappas. Madam Chair, Senator Brown, I think it's about 18. We'd have to, like I said, we'd have to do the math. They get about $20,000 a year in that's part of their subsidy.
All right.
They get per resident. And then they have to commit to stay in Minnesota for a period of time. And they are generally placed either in rural Minnesota or in an urban setting. But, you know, it's a small thing to do. We still have a shortage of family practice doctors.
Mr. Mishukanis.
And, Chair, and Senator Pappas, I can confirm it is 18 because we actually do the contract with them. They actually have two other physicians that they use the money to subsidize the residency practice for. So it's the number is kind of 20 in total. I would point out, though, on page 2 of Ms. Weidman's document, under the Mayo Clinic, you'll see that there is a reference to the Family Practice Residency Program down in Rochester. You do a single appropriation for that for Mayo, but in the budget documents it is separated and discussed. So.
For Mayo. Mm-hmm.
It's on line 52.
So, Madam Chair, just to conclude, I would just argue that we should treat them all similarly. You know, we either don't do any of them, which would be kind of hard for them in the middle of their family practice training, their internship training, to suddenly lose their fellowship, or we reduce them all 5% or 10% or something. But we should treat them all equally.
Ms. Weidman, you have something to explain.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to add, I was just checking with the Mayo Family Medical Residency Program. The money they get supports 25 residents.
Thank you. So that's the line 52 of this document.
Correct. Okay.
Mr. Mishukanis.
With that, Madam Chair and members, that concludes the presentation on the governor's budget. If there's any questions, we'd be happy to answer.
Are there further questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
I guess I just want to comment on the work-study cut. I mean, we have been moving that dollar up quite a bit. But that and child care, I mean, the argument is that you're helping students to stay in college by, and it's more difficult during a recession for them to provide, to get jobs on the private market. And so to have a work-study job, I had some students in my office today, and each of them said they were working three work-study jobs because they maybe only got 8 hours from one or inconsistent hours from one. And so they had to supplement with a couple work-study jobs. I think especially in rural Minnesota, this is going to be an issue of can they find jobs off campus. And then, of course, if they can't find jobs, then they end up borrowing more money. So then we add to their debt issue once they graduate. And the same thing with child care. If they can't find child care, they can't stay in college, or they can't afford to pay for child care. So I understand these are hard decisions to make, but I think during, you know, all the hard years that we've had over the last 8 years, we have actually protected child care and work study.
Mr. Mishukanis.
Madam Chair and members, I just wanted to remind you, I think we were before you a few weeks ago, and we talked about the shortfall on the state grant side because we've been asked why we're so protective of the state grant, and as Director Wright said, it is a core program. But I think I mentioned at that time there's a $35 million shortfall in that program for fiscal 12 and 13. We will have to ration under this recommendation in order to get to the base level funding. So the student share will go from 46 to about 46.9%, and there'll be a surcharge on the family share of about 8% too. It's not as dramatic as the rationing this year because we can do it over 2 years as opposed to just one, but there will be rationing under this scenario.
And how does that look in numbers wise? I know that I had the figures in front of me earlier today, but it was the $50 million that was rationed about a $100 reduction or something. That's what I'm looking for. Is what were those reductions? I can't remember if that's the number. I remember looking at it earlier today, and I. So what does that look like? The $32 million over the 2 years. What does that look like? Do you have any idea? Maybe you haven't even looked at those figures yet.
Well, actually, Madam Chair, we did a projections report last week, and if I could remember the numbers offhand, I'd give them to you.
Maybe that's what I was looking at this afternoon and can't remember.
I can't tell the committee that this will mean about 2,500 fewer recipients of the state grant. but I do not remember the average offhand.
Ms. Weidman?
Perhaps Mr. Mishakanis was getting to this yet, but I think in doing those projections, you also did not include the SLEEP and LEAP federal money. And so that, again, would impact, because they're not sure whether they'll be getting that money.
Okay.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members, these are two federal programs that provide money that we typically have used in the state grant program. The president's budget eliminates them. And the House does as well. So we're assuming that they will not be available. So for our projection purposes, we've simply zeroed those out.
And what was that? What was the number in relation?
Madam Chair, between the two, it's about $1.3 million a year.
Okay. So then we would be up a little higher on our 32 plus whatever those are. Okay. And Senator Brown had a question.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you tell me how long we've had this American Indian Scholarship program?
Mr. Mishakanis.
Madam Chair, members, our office has only had it for 3 years because it used to be operated out of the Department of Education. And it goes back decades as far as, I can't give you an exact date, but it's a very longstanding program.
And
Senator Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we have any other types of these programs for other groups of people, or is this special specifically for American Indians?
Mr. Mishakanis.
Madam Chair and members, this is the only program like this that's in our office.
Madam
Ms.
Chair.
Ms. Grimes.
Madam Chair and Senator, my understanding is that to some extent this is considered a fulfillment of treaty obligations, that it grew out of some old treaties that had to do with American Indians and being put on reservations and right to education and all that. I can't tell you exactly how old it is, but I believe that's why there is a program particularly for American Indian students.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, we have a similar obligation at the University of Minnesota Morris campus, I believe, where Indian students, and they probably have to qualify academically, but they can go there for tuition free. And I understand, my understanding, this program always has a waiting list. So to have 32 more students not receiving grants means the waiting list is going to be longer.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Grimes.
Senator, about 600 students a year receive these grants, and there are usually between 500 and 600 on the waiting list.
Additional questions?
What else?
Well, there are no other questions.
I did think of something.
Oh, okay, well, Senator Pappas thought first. Senator Thomas,
all right.
She's quicker. So Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think Senator Brown might have asked about the state grant. When Mr. Mishakanis, you said 2,500 people will probably lose the state grant. Those are people at the very income level, at the very high income level, and they usually only are getting $50 or $100. They're getting a very small grant amount. So it's not a significant burden for them. And they kind of fall off, and then I think you're right, then people a little farther down will lose $50 or $100.
Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is the federal money that you talked about that we're not getting, did that just come to us by formula, or was there a requirement of state money to match federal money?
Ms. Grimes.
Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni, there is a maintenance of effort requirement involved in that, but the amount you get by state also has – it's a formula. And every president since 1980 has tried to eliminate the what used to be called SSIG program and then became the LEAP program, Leveraging Educational Assistance Program. None have succeeded in eliminating it up till now, but up until now there hasn't been another body of Congress that was also seeking to eliminate it. So now both the President and the U.S. House are proposing to eliminate it.
So, Madam Chair, so
Senator Tomasoni.
What was our maintenance of effort?
Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni, my understanding is the maintenance of effort has to do with an average of the last either 3 to 5 years of what the state spent. So our maintenance of effort would be $124 million a year, which under the governor's recommendation we would meet if the federal money were to continue.
Okay.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This kind of goes back to the question we were asking before about the reduction versus increase. Because this page shows the adjustments from the 2012-13 base as reductions, but none of these, the base, I mean, 12-13 hasn't happened yet, and so when you talk about fewer students being eligible for these programs, they're not actually eligible now, are they? Those increased numbers from 10-11, those the increased in increased funds are not in the, currently in the system.
Chair, and Senator Anderson, if you're speaking to the state grant program, it is certainly true that we spent $119 million this year, spent $144 million next year. There'll be a lot more students on the program next year than this year because there's just more resources available. So the comparison from year to year, if it's an increase, compared from within the year against the base, it's a decrease.
And
Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, so just on, for example, the family practice that Senator Pappas was talking about, this wouldn't necessarily hit existing residents who are covered by that program or maybe some of the other things we were talking about, that these reductions would mean that next year's group would get, well, I suppose some of them could have a four-year allocation. All right. So it would, it could affect someone who started their program.
Who's in the middle of the program, right.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Pappas, did you have, or you were going to add to that?
I just wanted to add that I'm not sure if everyone knows that the second year of the state grant program was greatly reduced because of dollars shifted into the first year because there was a shortage. So, but that's not, but if you look at the two-year base, it's the 280.
Further questions? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, if you don't mind, since I'm new to this committee. So when a student gets a state grant, are they eligible? Is it just 1 year at a time, the application and the eligibility? You have to reapply every year. It's been a long time since my college loan years.
Madam
Ms.
Chair,
Grimes.
We rely on the free application for federal student aid so that students don't have to fill out a separate application for the federal Pell Grant from the state grant. And with the FAFSA, in recent years, they have changed it so that the renewal FAFSA is shorter and has fewer questions than the initial FAFSA a student fills out. Basically, the second year, they just ask them, you know, are the following things still true, your address, you know, and a bunch of things like that. And then they just ask you the questions that are likely to have changed from year to year, like your family's income.
So, Madam
Chair, Senator
Anderson. But for a student whose income hasn't changed, they could still experience ups and downs in the amount that they get every, during their college career. That's typical,
Ms.
I would
Grimes.
Think, with budget.
Madam
oh,
Chair,
budget.
Senator, yes.
Further questions? Well, I will thank you all very much, and congratulations, Dr. Wright. We will pass that on to the floor. And the private colleges have asked us to make a reminder that the private college scholars at the Capitol will be held Monday, February 28th from 11 to 1 in the Rotunda, and there will be undergraduate students from 14 Minnesota private colleges and with 25 projects. So please stop by in the Rotunda on the 28th and visit with those students. And again, to all of you, thank you very, very much for explaining all that. And with that, if there's no further business, we are adjourned.
I don't know exactly where we are. My husband's. So.